Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Welcome to a special edition of both the Fire Marshal's Corner and Campus Fire Watch Radio. For this month, we're doing a joint broadcast of both podcasts focusing on the tragedy of Virginia Tech that claimed 32 lives. We're not going to look at the details of the incident itself. That'll be the subject of a number of investigations and panels that will delve into the specifics. What we are looking at are several strategies and ideas that can be used in preparing for any incident, whether it's an active shooter, a hurricane, a fire, or any other disaster that might strike on a campus. We combine the shows for this month because these very issues cut across both areas, those of the HJ, or authority having jurisdiction, and the campus officials. As an example, last week I met with several senior officials from a school that was looking at what they should do. They were talking about security, how to lock down, etc. The pendulum was swinging towards security concerns and life safety was falling to the side. It's so important to ensure that this does not become the norm across the nation. We need to take advantage of this heightened awareness and implement a broad spectrum of solutions that will address all of the concerns and not to the detriment of any single one. Joining us this month, we have a series of experts that will be talking about incident command, mass notification, and interoperability of communications. These are just three out of many issues that have to be addressed, but three critical ones. And joining us today is Bruce Frazier, who just recently retired from over 40 years with Simplex Grinnell and still remains incredibly active in the industry. He's been he's a member of a number of NFPA committees, as well as National Electrical Manufacturers Association and Society of Fire Protection Engineers. Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
You're welcome, Ed.
I asked Bruce to come on and talk to us about mass notification because, as a result of the Virginia Tech tragedy, there's been certainly a lot more interest given to alerting people to dangerous conditions, dangerous situations, quickly and effectively. And mass notification is something that Bruce is very knowledgeable in and has been very active in developing the standards on this over the years. So I think maybe probably the first thing is maybe, Bruce, you can start with just a primer on what is mass notification and what kind of role does it play?
Well, I think you mentioned it well. Mass notification is really a means of providing timely notification to give occupants and actually those in the immediate vicinity of a building warning of impending threats and other dangers and to be able to then instruct them to do in response to those threats.
Now, this is a lot more localized as opposed to the old civil defense system, which would, you know, you'd get that alert tone that would go over nationwide on radios. This is for a specific location or a specific building, isn't it?
Yes. The military actually uses it to go beyond just a building or a surrounding. They use it for their bases and also very much like what a campus could use it today, where you're talking to multiple buildings or multiple areas of properties.
What's some of the technology they're using in doing this today?
Well, actually, to go back a ways, the fire alarm systems, the voice fire alarm systems, have been using this technology for, oh, I'm going to say 30 years or more, and very reliably, and they've had the capability of doing that, but generally for fire purposes. And this just expands it a bit. The technologies used now kind of expand on that by taking it and giving the capability of providing a wide area notification, in other words, multiple buildings. The technology to get it from one building to another could be a wired system. It could be over fiber optics. It could be over telephone lines, or it could be a wireless communication. And we're seeing more and more wireless methods today.
Now, when you're doing mass notification, what kind of messages are you trying to transmit, and what kind of, what kind of information are you trying to relay to the people?
Well, the information would be pertinent to what exactly is happening. There are two ways that you can provide the messaging. One is a what we would call a standard canned message, and it might be something if you were using a mass notification, let's say you had a building that stored chemicals, and one of the dangers might be a chemical release, maybe in a refrigeration plant, ammonia, and you might have a canned message to alert people of those particular dangers. So you would just have to operate a switch or a sensor would send the activate the message. But what we're seeing more and more today is the events as they unfold, you've got to react to them as they happen. And there can be changing effects. In other words, you might have a fire in a building, but it might lead to something else where you would want to provide maybe not evacuation out of the north entrance, but you'd want to, because something is happening there, and it brings to mind some of the incidents that have happened on school properties where someone will purposely pull a fire alarm to have people come out one area and then take advantage of that situation. So by providing live information, you can react to something like that and have people stop, reverse what they're doing, and react in a different way.
And how effective are they? I mean, how do people respond to these messages? Is it an effective method of controlling people's actions and directing them in a different direction and that sort of thing?
Well, that's a good point. There are multiple studies going on right now as to the reaction, how people react to various alarms and signals. And typically, the more information you can give a person behaviorally, they will react to that information.
Now, I know there's also some different applications. We've been talking about sound, audio messages that are given, too. How about visual displays? Is that another mechanism, too, that can be used in mass notification?
Certainly. Many of the displays that would be provided would be the typical flat screen displays, or you may have the LED lighted displays. Some have exit signs that will actually change the wording to provide additional information. There are systems also that will kind of capture your internal network and provide instructions right up on your local computer screen.
No, that's an interesting application there.
Okay, it's not without its. You have to when you put a plan together, you have to really think it out, because you have to think now, how are you going to get, who is going to be responsible for getting the message out, and these are all of the things that you have to put together, so that when you get the system, it's going to work reliably and dependably.
Now, let's focus on the campus kind of environment for a minute here and look at some of the hardware that may be employed in that kind of environment. You've got certainly the buildings themselves, where perhaps you'd use something like the fire alarm system to help carry your message. In the large open areas that you might have between buildings, what kind of hardware is there available to do a mass notification in that kind of environment?
Well, for let's say, and again, I'll refer to the military and for their parade grounds and some of their open spaces in the military, and this would be very appropriate for campuses also. The what's called giant voice or wide area signaling is done by sometimes by high-powered tower speakers. Sometimes they're solar-powered speakers. These are larger, more high-powered speakers than you'd find internally in a building. They'd be 500 to 2,500 watts potentially, and would cover purposely a large area.
And also, you'd mentioned doing things like capturing the internal networks and sending things to computers. Everybody on campus nowadays has a cell phone, and where there's instant messaging and everything else. Is that another application that can be used to get messages to students and others? Is that another platform for delivery of mass notification?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we use that today for other things, to for fire alarm systems, for instance, to broadcast maintenance alerts to the maintenance staff. What this would entail would be then getting all of the students to register their cell phones. This is the campus environment, and as well as the teaching and staff, so that all of their numbers would be in a bank, and when you would hit that bank, a message would go out to all of those cell phones. So yes, that's something that could be done. I haven't seen that application used, but certainly the technology is here to do it, and we use it now on a smaller scale.
Well, I have to imagine that after Virginia Tech, everybody will be looking at a lot of different types of applications just like this that would work in the campus environment. And that's probably one of them, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, well, I've heard you call it the teachable moment, too, where sometimes it takes an incident, very disturbing incident, to kind of raise people's awareness and to really give some thought as to what to put in place for things that may happen like that.
Now, you had mentioned earlier, too, that it takes some training in terms of the first responders and using these systems. I take it it's not just a simple case of picking up a microphone and transmitting a message. You have to have some understanding of what you're doing and what you're saying planned out in advance to make sure that you give accurate and timely information to everybody that's involved. So the fire service definitely has to be involved, I would assume, in the installation and the use of these systems. It's not just something they can walk in off the street and be ready to use.
Although they do have that experience with the voice fire alarm systems, and it is very, very similar. You're absolutely right, though. Someone that's not familiar with using a microphone might have a tendency to talk too fast, to provide information that may not sound rational. That's not a good thing. It's very important that the system be provided and have a high degree of intelligibility, so that the people that are hearing the message will be able to understand it also. So it's a part on both the speaker and the listener. It's important that messages be repeated, for instance, because when you provide the first message, people might not get all of the information. But if the message is repeated, then they fill that information that they might have missed the first time.
What do you do in the campus environment where you have a number of people from different countries speaking foreign languages, and you may have somebody that's hearing impaired as well? Are there any sort of provisions given for those types of situations?
Well, fortunately, the society in general will take care of a lot of that. People will look around and see what others are doing, how others are reacting, and we also tend to help others that may not be able to have the understanding or to be able to hear or understand what's going on. So we as a society are pretty good at that. However, as we talked about before, we also have capabilities of providing multiple languages. This would be, of course, if someone is doing the live messaging, they would have to have the capability of the particular languages that are in would be most likely used. Generally, what I've seen on campuses is predominant in the North America anyway, is English first, and in some areas would be followed by a Spanish message, the same with the same content.
Are you familiar with any campuses currently using this technology? I mean, is it in place at campuses, or is it predominantly been a military-type application so far?
Well, predominantly military, because the Department of Defense requires on certain bases for this to happen. But more and more campuses are using it, and there are several that we're in process of installing now. And because of the Virginia Tech incident, there are more and more inquiries. There's nothing that mandates, nothing that code requires these systems. but it does provide the instant communication capabilities that is desirable not only for emergencies, but for maybe social events on campuses also.
And without naming any specific vendors, because we're not into that, what kind of companies install these things? Is it something that's in the fire alarm industry, for example? Is that who's putting these in? Or if I was a campus administrator, where would I go to find one of these?
Well, I would say all of the fire alarm providers will have systems that will do mass notification to various degrees. So I would say virtually all of those, because we've been doing that for years. But there are others that are also in the industry that have been doing the giant voice, the larger systems, the military bases, that and these people would be into sound and communications. I would think probably if you're looking for something, I get always pop up the Google screen and kind of look for something mass notification, and right. I haven't done that, but I would imagine that you would you see a host of various vendors that would be out there.
Right.
I would think what you would want is someone that is going to be around for a while to be able to service and maintain the system.
Well, we've been talking to Bruce Frazier, just retired after 40 years with Simplex Grinnell, and is very active in NFPA and NEMA and SFPE, and very knowledgeable about mass notification technology. And we really appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Bruce.
My pleasure, Ed.
And again, this is a special show where we're focusing on some of the technologies and the solutions that can be used by campuses and communities across the country. And today we were talking about mass notification, where you can alert large numbers of people very quickly to an incident to give them the proper way to respond. Joining us today is Fire Chief Cliff Jones with the Tempe Fire Department. And Tempe is the home of Arizona State University. And I appreciate you joining us today, Chief.
My pleasure.
I'd like to talk about incident command. Now, I know that out there in Arizona, in Tempe, in the Phoenix area, incident command is something that's been in place for quite a long time and is strongly used. But for many of our listeners, it may be a somewhat foreign concept or just something that they don't use on a regular basis. So perhaps you can start with just a little brief overview of what incident command is.
I think incident command is a process to bring overall oversight to an incident, if you will. It's designed to accomplish several things. First, it's designed to fix responsibility for the command of that incident and the management of that incident. It's to ensure that there's strong, direct, and visible command, that there's a framework in place that outlines activities and responsibilities, and that there's a system for orderly transfer of command. So it identifies essentially standard operating procedures for management of an incident, as opposed to we have standard operating procedures for tasks at an incident. Most departments do. This is the standard operating procedure for how the incident is going to be managed.
And it's something that it's extremely useful when you're doing multi-jurisdictional or multi-agency events, isn't it?
Absolutely, Ed. I think that's the critical point for incident command, or what's commonly called today unified command. That's where unified command really comes into play. And most large-scale incidents are going to involve jurisdictional overlap, either between multiple fire departments, multiple police departments, or other agencies within your own jurisdiction that would be considered a managerial overlap, that is, public works and PD and water utilities and fire, all working together on a common incident. So unified command addresses the overlap of jurisdictional authority, if you will. I think the critical realization is just what you said, is that there is overlap at major incidents, and the command procedure or unified command procedure is the primary mechanism for addressing that.
Now, is incident command and unified command something that's only used on major incidents, or does it work on, really any size or scale of incident?
I believe strongly that it works on any size of incident. As a matter of fact, it's more than a belief. It's virtually a necessity. If incident command, whatever term an agency uses for it, National Incident Management System, Unified Command, Incident Command, or simply command procedure, it needs to be used every day. If it's going to work effectively on a big incident, which may only occur, you know, once every 6 months, once every 3 months, once every 5 years, then it needs to be an ingrained part of the day-to-day operational procedure of the agency, and essentially it becomes a part of the organization's culture, is how they operate under an incident command system. And if it's used every day, it has more of a potential to become part of the culture.
Now, so it sounds like it's scalable. You can start with it on a small incident, and then as the incident grows, you can add the layers or the resources you need. Is that the kind of the idea behind it?
That's exactly the idea behind it, and most incident management systems are geared exactly that way. In other words, they are expandable. Flexibility is a key component of incident command, and certainly of incident command systems. So the system needs to be flexible so that it adapts to the size of the incident, but then it can also grow as the incident grows.
And probably the reverse, too, right? You know, when it comes time to scale these things down, that's always a process and a half. You know, the emergency's over, now it's time to start scaling things down. So incident command can also be used in reverse, can it, as you start kicking units loose and start transferring responsibilities and command to other organizations?
Precisely. That's what we call decommitting units, and that's a part of the incident command system, is a structured way to do that so that everybody knows what to expect and knows how to react appropriately when they get orders to decommit.
Let's talk about, you know, incident command in the academic environment. For example, ASU, Arizona State University, out there where you are located in your town, your city. What kind of position or what role would a university play in the incident command system?
The university plays a key role, and using Arizona State University as an example, they utilize the National Incident Management System, that is the ASU Police Department. We are in Tempe, the fire department for ASU. They have their own Emergency Operations Center, but they also co-locate with us at times in our City Emergency Operations Center, because virtually any large-scale incident at Arizona State University or in the city of Tempe proper is going to involve both agencies, because ASU is so large. So we operate under the day-to-day expectation that we will utilize a unified command system.
Now, does that, when you're dealing with ASU, does it involve just the PD, or other parts of it get brought into play? And I'm thinking, you know, gee, their PIO, their facilities people, their, you know, the housing. There's a role for these different entities within the incident command system as well, isn't there?
That's correct. And ultimately, it involves dealing with everyone, and that goes back to jurisdictional overlap. That term refers to not just other geographical jurisdictions, but operational jurisdictions within the same geographic area, and that's what we have in Tempe with the City of Tempe and ASU. But we can end up working with their risk management people, with their environmental people, certainly with their facilities people. So it's across the spectrum in terms of all of their departments, and as a matter of fact, at times it can include academic departmental people, people from the chemistry department or people from the life sciences department at times become an integrated part of the emergency management system.
And it's not just really for emergencies either, because I remember you telling me about, I think you had President Bush out there, which must have taken a lot of logistics and set up and then running the incident, even though nothing happened. Did incident command come into play in setting up and preparing and running that kind of incident?
Absolutely. We not only have had the president here a number of times, but we hosted, you may recall, the last presidential debate, which was a huge undertaking. almost on the size and scope of having hosted the Super Bowl a number of years ago. But for the presidential debate, we clearly implemented the incident management system, and that was an integrated, once again, effort of ASU, the city of Tempe, the National Guard's 91st Civil Support Team, a whole host of state agencies, FBI, Secret Service, everyone was involved in that.
And for a lot of these organizations, was incident command a foreign concept to them, or is it something that they're using? You bring up the FBI and the Secret Service and such.
That's a great question, Ed, and they are much more accustomed to day-to-day use of incident management system than I perceived that they were years ago. So it is not a foreign concept to them, and they're ready to move forward with it at virtually any time.
But like I said in the beginning, I think that for a lot of the academic people in administration and universities, that incident command is going to be a little bit unusual. You know, the police department might be familiar with it and use it, but when you start getting into the upper echelons, it's going to be something they're not going to quite understand their role or the purpose behind it. But somebody even like the chancellor, you know, has a role, has a place, or has a position in the incident command operation, doesn't he?
That's correct. We're fortunate in Tempe. We have a we not only have a mayor and city council that are interested in being supportive and participative, but we have a university president that understands the whole process of potential for incidents to occur and what it's going to take to manage those incidents, and he is very supportive in both areas.
And while it takes obviously some training and knowledge to know how to work incident command, it's not like it's, you know, real rocket science either, is it? I mean, it's just something that any community and any college can really pick up and learn and start to implement. It doesn't take a major undertaking, does it?
Well, it takes a serious commitment. I don't think it's as major an undertaking in terms of time and talent as it is in committing a reasonable amount of time and talent to make it happen and to integrate it to the point that it's a functional part of every emergency operation. I think that's the key element, is making the commitment to move forward and do the training and keep up with the training. One of the things certainly with university communities is some of them can be highly transient in terms of professionals moving from one area of the organization to another, or moving from simply one organization to a similar organization in another state. So you always have people coming into the system, in a system that large. The main campus here at ASU is about 55,000 students, all of the faculty and support staff that it takes to make that operation effective. There is a huge commitment required to maintain a reasonable level of not only introductory training into incident management, but ongoing training. And then probably the most critical element of all of that is periodically exercising the system so that people are accustomed to using it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that the tragedy at Virginia Tech shows us the importance, too, of different organizations and different entities all working together to try to minimize the impact of any incident. I mean, I can only imagine what it was like to suddenly have to transport 32 people and locate them, treat them, transport them, and everything else. And the fire department must have been faced with a monumental task in trying to just coordinate all that activity, which is what incident command is absolutely designed to do.
That's correct. It's meant to support all that, to make it more efficient, to make it more effective, and to make it safer. And I think the safety of personnel is a critical part of incident management, and just a critical part of why it's so important that agencies utilize that system.
Well, we've been talking about the incident command system with Fire Chief Cliff Jones from the Tempe Fire Department out in Tempe, Arizona, which is also the home to Arizona State University. And we really appreciate you taking the time, Chief, to fill us in a little bit on incident command. If you look down on the page below, you'll be able to find out a lot of information, a lot more information about it, and some links to some great sites. So we appreciate you taking the time, Chief.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Okay. Talking about Incident Command here on Campus Firewatch Radio and the Fire Marshal's Corner.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And joining us is Alan Caldwell, who's a Senior Advisor of Government Relations for the International Association of Fire Chiefs. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Wow, you're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
The topic that I've asked Alan to join us to discuss is that of interoperability. Now, I have to admit, probably the biggest thing is I have a hard time pronouncing it.
Spelling, it's a challenge, too.
I'm sure that's a challenge, too, yeah. But with incidents such as what we saw down in Virginia Tech, where you know you're bringing in a lot of different entities, a lot of different organizations that have to work together very quickly under you know critical conditions right there, communications is paramount. And this is something that's really been on the IFC's radar screen for some time, hasn't it, Alan?
That has indeed.
Yeah. Maybe you can just start with a little bit of an overview of what interoperability is all about.
Interoperability is the ability for public safety agencies, and I guess it would apply to more, but we're public safety, so it would apply to public safety agencies to talk to one another, as well as to share data with one another via normal communication systems, to do so with one another on demand and in real time, and when needed, and in accordance with protocols that have been agreed upon. And it's a situation where, unlike we've had some members of Congress that thought interoperability meant that firefighter Schmidlap in Boston could talk to firefighter O'Hagan in San Francisco anytime he wanted, and such is certainly not what public safety officials envision. But to have a system or a system of systems throughout the country that have the capability in real time, on demand, and in accordance with protocols for agencies to talk among themselves and with one another. So that's basically what interoperability is all about.
And what's been the hurdles to it? I mean, it sounds like a pretty basic concept, but I'm sure that there's some significant hurdles to actually implementing it and making it happen. What are some of the challenges that communities are facing in getting this in place?
We can start with kind of the identified challenges, and then work our way up into some of the more more difficult ones to overcome. But incompatibility, as well as aging equipment, is a huge challenge. Some systems from jurisdiction A to jurisdiction B are simply not compatible to create an interoperable system around. We've got limited equipment standards in the digital standard for wireless radios. We've got P25, which is a good standard, but for a lot of the equipment out there, there is not a standard. Some are in the process of being developed, but they're not there yet. Spectrum is an issue. We operate, public safety currently operates on about 8 different bands, and a new band is coming into existence on February the 18th of 2009. That's the 700 megahertz band, which will certainly help, but fragmented and limited spectrum is a problem. We need to talk about budgets too. And budgets are driven by life cycles of systems, as well as funding mechanisms. How are we going to raise the money? Is it going to be through tax bases, through bond issues, through benevolence, through the federal government? However, we've got the money situation. And now we come to the one that's probably the most difficult to overcome. Actually, it could be the easiest if you can check the egos at the door. But that's the planning and coordination, and the whole way of achieving interoperability begins with leadership and partnerships. and it has to include a desire of certainly the public safety agencies. They have to see a need to talk with one another first, and then they have to come up with some basic concept. Well, if we could talk to one another, what would it look like? And it could be within jurisdiction A, the police department and the fire department see that they run enough calls together. I'm a retired chief fire officer in Fairfax County, and yesterday and today they ran two separate weapons of mass destruction incidents. That's not making the press, but they have, and police and fire have been placed on one tactical channel for making sure that they communicate. The fire department in jurisdiction A and the fire department in jurisdiction B have to have some idea that we run mutual aid. Maybe it would be nice to have the ability to communicate with one another. Or maybe they don't run mutual aid and they're thinking about it, and communications is going to be becoming a part of the plan. But planning is really the key to everything interoperable. Without a plan, you don't have interoperability. And in order to have a plan, you have to have leadership, and you have to have the mayor of jurisdiction A inside of county B talking to the county executive, thinking that this is going to be in the best interest of the voters and of the citizens. It becomes really a political issue.
Now, this was a major issue at the World Trade Center, wasn't it?
Absolutely it was. But there were other issues at the World Trade Center, both instances. The first one in 1993 and the bombing, and then, of course, the two airplanes flying into it, but there were other significant problems. But yes, police don't talk to the fire in New York City. They do now, but they didn't then.
And in terms of looking at the technology and the hardware, it's not just a simple case of building a bridge between the two. Community A has one frequency, Community B has another frequency. Can they do something that just creates a bridge between them, or does one of the communities have to opt out of what they've got to become compatible with another community?
No, there is a lot of equipment out there. And by the way, technology is not the issue. I'd like to go over something in a minute here, but let's address this first question. There are ways that that you can get disparate frequencies. You can get stuff coming from analog to digital. You can get encrypted messages to be unencrypted and then re-encrypted. And you can do all this through bridging technology. It's out there. It's available. But what you have to have is a plan. And you have to know before you buy, for example, an ACU-1000, and there are other technologies out there, and many fire and police departments have them on hand, but you have to know what you're going to do with them. What's the plan? What frequencies do we need to pre-program to have them available? Where are we going to store this equipment? How often are we going to exercise it? Does it have battery backup? Who's going to haul it under what circumstances? All these things have to be agreed to and decided ahead of time before you go out and buy something and store it someplace. So yes, Ed, you can. There are all kinds of bridging equipment out there. It has to be bought and put in service with a plan.
So what has really been happening? I mean, it's an issue that I know a lot of people have been talking about for a long time. So what's happening nowadays to really try to make it happen?
Well, I've got some good news, because there's a lot that's happening out there. The IFC has been involved in actually getting a federal office called SAFECOM up and running, and making sure that SAFECOM had bottom-up information through practitioners. And SAFECOM, which is an office at the Department of Homeland Security, is a practitioner-driven federal effort. It's a focus on interoperability, And it indicates that the federal government understands that interoperability is important, and how can it help some 55,000 to 60 separate public safety agencies gather themselves together and become interoperable? It's a daunting task, and some of the things that have been done. For the manufacturers, a statement of requirements has been developed. It's based on scenarios, but it would offer manufacturers the opportunity to see what is it that public safety needs. So the SOR, the statement of requirements, is a very, very key document. Federal monies are available through several different programs, and on what basis should federal dollars be given to local agencies to help them, or going through the states then to help local agencies upgrade and become more interoperability. And to that end, grant guidance has been developed, and I sat on that committee, for example, representing the IFC and law enforcement, and others with a public safety background have helped to develop grant guidance that's supposed to apply to all grants, all federal grants going to states and to local government. One of the most important documents developed by SAFECOM is called the Interoperability Continuum, and there it shows the six major factors that must be considered for interoperability. And I'll just read them. I have a copy of this in front of me, and a copy is also available at safecomprogram.gov.
And we'll put a link to that on the webpage down below here so people can get to it pretty easily.
Okay, that's a good idea. But going from the top one is governance. And that's the hard one. If you can get governance starts with planning, and it starts with agencies and jurisdictions willing to work with one another. The second one is standard operating procedures, because individual SOPs have to be developed as to how interoperability will work. Technology. There's any number of different ways that technology can provide interoperability, all the way from just swapping radios to the ultimate, which is a standards-based shared systems, and there are several others in between. Training and exercises. I cannot overstate the importance of this. If firefighters and police officers and emergency medical technicians don't train daily on this, it has to be in daily usage, then it won't work when you really need it. That's the problem with taking some of these gateways and sticking them in a closet someplace and say, okay, Charlie, when the big one comes, it's in the closet there. Well, it's almost useless. And then usage. We need to have it done the best is daily throughout the region. Surely we need to do it from time to time with planned events and as part of local and regional incident management exercises. But those are the those are the five, and then of course planning and collaboration among the areas and money are the things that undergird those five parts of the interoperability continuum.
Now, given that some of our listeners are campus officials, they might be campus administrators, they might be campus police chiefs, there are some fire departments on campus.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about is very applicable to them, too, because they're first responders, they're emergency responders, just like everybody else out there.
Absolutely, and they need to walk out to the edge of the campus and see what jurisdictions are there to help them, who's second due, who's first due, who's going to come when a big event happens. And it doesn't have to be a campus shooter. It can be their University of Florida catches a hurricane, or the University of San Francisco catches an earthquake, or University of Kansas catches a tornado. Whatever the incident is, they are probably going to need help. Well, they need to plan on it ahead of the incident, and that is the message, Ed. If there's ever a message, they need to look ahead. what are the risks? What threats do I have? Okay, what are kind of worst case scenarios? And then you can say, well, that's not likely to happen, but these things could happen based on where we are and what natural things are around us. What are the jurisdictions that immediately surround us? Who do we call for help? And when you decide that, then comes the hard part, and that's getting somebody to come over to your office, or you take your hat in your hand and you go to their office and say, hey, let's start planning together.
So it sounds like the real hurdle is not certainly not equipment, certainly not technical, but the human aspect in these things.
It is absolutely the human aspect. And I heard one person that's very knowledgeable about interoperability say that interoperability is 80% human and 20% technology. And somebody stood up in a room of the meeting and said, I disagree with that. It's 90% human and 10% technology. But that gives you an idea of what those that are really knowledgeable about this think.
Well, we've been talking with Alan Caldwell, who's the Senior Advisor for Government Relations at the International Association of Fire Chiefs, about interoperability of communications, which is a significant factor in any sort of large-scale incident, or almost any incident, really, that may be happening in a campus or a community where different organizations have to coordinate their operations and talk to each other. And it's a critical one, but there is some very good movement in that area. And we really appreciate you taking the time and talking with us today, Alan.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity, Ed. Thank you very much.
Okay. And we'll have some links to some of the information that Alan was talking about right below on the page here. And you're listening to Campus Fire Watch Radio and the Fire Marshal's Corner in a special show looking at some of the issues relating to a major or a mass casualty type of incident such as we saw at Virginia Tech. Well, thanks for listening to this special edition of Campus Fire Watch Radio and Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Camo, and this is radio at firehouse.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.